Welcome to Fine Tuning Your Work. I'm your fearless leader for at least the next hour. My name's Laura Poole. And before I jump in, I'm going to explain a little bit about why I'm here and what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to get a little informal poll of what you're hoping to learn so I can make sure that it's useful for you. All right, so what I'm going to be talking about today is fine tuning your work, your written work, before it's published. And I'm specifically talking about copy editing, whether it's done by the publisher or by you. So this is about cleaning up your article. All the substantive work is done. The bulk of the writing is done. The organization is finished. You've fleshed out everything. You've got your references or whatever needs doing. And this is about cleaning up the file, cleaning up the spelling, the punctuation, the grammar, all the little technicalities that can distract a reader from your content. So people may wonder, well, why would I need to fine-tune my work if I've written it? Isn't it fine? Well, it probably is, 90% of the way there. But the point is, if you've cleaned up your work neatly, it makes the publisher think well of you and want to work with you. And all work is copy edited from a publisher. So if a copy editor has to see your work, they're also going to think nicely of you. I've been a copy editor for 15 years. And when I did journal articles for a major university press, I would come in and say, okay, these journal authors get a nice fruit basket because they did a very good job, and these get spanked because they did not do a good job. So we had a little mental game of spank the author. So essentially, don't be that author. If your content is very, very readable, it's more likely to be accepted, especially if you're submitting blind, like a journal article or a book that you haven't been solicited for or haven't got a contract for, but you want to get published. If your work is readable, the reviewers will read your content, and they're not going to get tripped up in your language or your punctuation or your spelling. So they're going to say, this person has worthwhile ideas, it's well organized, it's coherent, it's useful. They're going, geez, they can't spell. So it's about presenting yourself in the best light. Also, as soon as the work is cleaned up and ready to go, it keeps a schedule and budget within means. Because the heavier the edit that's needed to clean it up, the longer it takes and the more it costs. So anything you can do to help the publisher stay within budget and within schedule is always greatly appreciated. And it builds a lot of goodwill with the publisher. Now, who here is a textbook author? Okay, we got a couple. What are some of the other roles here?
Faculty.
Okay, and you do some writing, I imagine. Some journal, people write books.
Hoping to.
Okay, so there's books authors, journal article authors.
Developmental
editors, actually, that's excellent. Glad to see one here. I'm mostly just a copy editor. I've tried developmental editing. I don't feel confident doing scholarly level developmental editing. So who am I? Why am I talking to you today? Well, my name's Laura Poole. My company is Archer Editorial Services. I provide professional scholarly copy editing, mostly to university presses. Lately, I've joined the TAA this year and really enjoyed it because I get to work with high-quality authors, and I don't usually work with authors because most of them would come to me, really can't write. But since I do scholarly level editing, I'm really glad to work with scholars and people who are good authors. I've got 15 years of experience in publishing. I've run my company for the past 13 years, and I've worked for such publishers as Oxford University Press, Duke University Press, Springer Verlag, various other nonfiction publishers. I do travel books, I've done war memoirs, but I really, really like nonfiction and I really like scholarly stuff. The heavily cited, heavily annotated stuff. Ooh, I love it. Just dig my claws in it and have fun with it. I've done medical textbooks, I've done legal textbooks, I've done all kinds of scholarly stuff for Oxford. Apparently the math girl over at Oxford, whenever they get a math manuscript, they send it to me because As somebody asked me, do you have to understand the math? I'm like, heck no! I just have to know how to read it and punctuate it and know when there should be a space in here and you've missed a closed parenthesis, that kind of thing. So my job involves all those little technicalities of making sure a text is ready to be published. So we're going to cover ideas for getting your text ready for journals and books. And there is a lot to cover. I don't expect you to memorize these little details. What I'm trying to do here is to give you an idea of the kinds of things, the minutiae, that can really improve your work. on a basic level. I'll be happy to take questions throughout. I may go kind of fast. If something is unclear, raise your hand. I'm happy to respond. I do talk fast when I'm excited, I admit. Also, let me know if I'm going too fast. And if you have a specific question about anything I've said, just let me know. Okay, so my presentation will roughly follow what's on your handout. I don't use slides because I'm not used to them. And I actually prefer a handout so you have something to take home with you. So the first thing to do, fine-tuning your work, is presumed you have already written it. It is 99% in final draft stage. There's not going to be any more substantive changes. There's no more tables to make. There's no more figure to generate. Your data's there. All your conclusions and abstracts, any elements that have to be there are there. It's been rearranged the way it's supposed to be, possibly with the help of a developmental editor who works on substantive topics like that. If you're working with an acquisitions editor at a press on a book, they'll help you tell what elements they want and where it should be fleshed out. Or if you're working on a journal article, obviously you need to have your methods finished and your data finished and your conclusion and all that information. So it's essentially 99% done. The fine-tuning comes the final phase before you finally submit it. Okay? The first thing to do once you've written everything up and got it where you want it to do is to check the instructions from the publisher. And if you have, you can find those online for publishers if you're submitting a book blind. If you don't have a contract yet, they'll say instructions for publishers here for authors. Here is how you should submit. Your manuscript should be double spaced, 12 point, Times Roman type, unjustified, blah, blah, blah. They need it to be consistent so they can get an accurate page count. And, you know, because, it's 350 words per page. If we have this many pages, here's how long we expect. When it's typeset, it'll be X size. Journals are even more rigid with this. Usually printed right in the journal or on the journal website are very specific instructions for authors. And anything that I tell you today is general stuff. Everything is trumped by instructions to authors. That is the final word on how your document should be formatted, what should appear in it, in what order it should appear, that kind of thing. So I may say, take out all spaces after periods, but if the instructions to authors say otherwise, always follow the instructions to authors. Because it is a pain in the patukas to get stuff that doesn't follow the instructions to authors. It can be expensive and time-consuming to correct. Okay? If you're working on journal articles, it helps immensely to have a copy of the journal to refer to. As a copy editor, I use that all the time. It's like, ooh, I know I've seen that before. Flip, 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 flip. Went back through. Oh, here's how we did it in issue number 3 and issue number 4, and I can just make it match that. It's a terrific way to make sure your journal article submission matches what already appears in the journal. It makes it easier for the review board to review it and give you comments. Because they'd rather work on the content of your article. This is good, it's useful, it'll be appropriate for our readers, it fits with this, rather than saying, oh, you put the methods after this, and you named it this, and you forgot the keywords. So just make it match what's in the journal. So the general overall kind of changes you can make in the main text, and I put one of these here. Take out all extra spaces and lines. Some of you took typing in grade school or high school, like me. Put two spaces after a period or a colon. Not anymore. You don't have to do that. In fact, publishers will automatically take it out. It's very, very easy to take it out. If your habit is to type it, go ahead and type it. And then when you're finished, do a global search and replace in Word. You do the find and replace feature. Find two spaces, replace one space. And repeat it until there's no more corrections caught. It really is easy. Take out all extra line spaces as well. A lot of people put extra line spaces to try to make things line up. You don't need them. They'll be taken out anyway. And it messes up your page flow if you put in a whole bunch of extra line spaces. Again, these are the little kind of details that do matter when you're submitting your work for publication. Check that the order of elements is appropriate. Particularly in terms of journal articles, you want, for instance, if it says do the abstract, then the introduction, then the methods, then the results. Some articles will have the methods come second to last. They'll discuss the results first. So you want to make sure everything flows appropriately. Some people will have the keywords before the abstract. Some places will have it after. So just make sure it matches the instructions to the authors or the copy of the journal article. And obviously, if you're writing a book, you might have chapter objectives before the chapter overview, or the overview might become before the objectives. It depends on how formal the publisher wants to have it listed. Does that make sense so far? Okay, I've seen some nods. Good, excellent, okay. Feel free to give me a quizzical expression if you're like, huh? I'll see what I can do to answer your questions. Okay, here's an important thing. Make sure you use a readable font. I've been editing for authors lately who have articles written in Helvetica, and it drives me nuts because the Helvetica is hard to read. It has no serif on it. Serif is that extra little bits on top of a letter. That, you know, a plain one will just have two lines, and then there's like the exit sign back there. The exit is it's a sans serif font. There's no serif on it. And if you look at your conference proceedings or your handout, there is a little bit of serif on here. So the T in fine tuning has a little bit of extra dangly bits on the T, whereas there's none over there. That's what serif is. And it makes it much more easily readable. The problem with using something like Helvetica or Arial that has no serif is that it can be really difficult to tell what some of the letters are. A lowercase L, a capital I, and the number 1 all look alike. And in the old days, a lot of people used to type a lowercase L for a 1. But if it gets transferred into the typesetting program with sets with serif, it looks wrong, they're not spaced correctly. Also, and here's a weird one I see in Helvetica a lot. R and N looks like M because they're so close together. So you might be talking about yarns, but it looks like yams, which would be really confusing. And it's just hard to see, even on screen. It really is. So I always recommend Times New Roman 12-point type. Double-spaced is excellent. It's much easier to read on the screen and on paper. Almost all the editing is done on screen anymore. And the instructions to the authors may tell you also to do things like it should be double spaced throughout except for the abstract and except for the references. References sometimes are triple spaced because they're very heavily edited. But it's all in there. Usually you want no justification because it breaks words in weird places and it makes the spacing. So a rag write or no justification. And generally 1-inch margins all around. Sometimes they'll want line numbers, sometimes they won't. They may want line numbers in early editions, so reviewers and the editorial board can say, on page 5, line 26, correct this. And it's easier to find. But generally it's not printed in the typeset material. I've covered up my notes. That was foolish. Okay. Another key thing to emphasize a word, and this is not something that's generally known outside of publishing. When it is typeset, a word is emphasized in italics. It is not underlined, and it is never in all caps. So use italics only for emphasis. Don't use all caps, and don't use underlining. It won't hurt you to use underlining, but you'll never see it in formal publishing. And most typesetting programs will interpret that and reset it as italic. Especially don't do headers and underline. I hate that. I've just been doing this so long, underline is like, oh, it looks round. But it will be changed anyway. In the running text, which is your main text, your descriptive prose of whatever it is you're writing about, make sure that you do a very careful spell check. And remember that spell check will not catch everything. In fact, it'll change some weird things. But if you do it carefully, you can find odd things you missed. It does help to have another set of eyes on a proof as spelling, because you can catch things like, ooh, I typed pubic when I'm in public, whoops. East instead of ease, pain instead of paint. That's weird. I do a lot of medical editing and I've heard paint management when it should have been pain management. Yeah, spell check's not going to check that. Yeah, it's another set of eyes will catch that. It is virtually impossible to edit your own work at that level, especially if you've been reworking it as you write it. You just can't see the mistakes anymore. I see some nods. Yeah, I'm terrible for that. I can't edit my own work. That's why, paradoxically, why I make a living editing other people's work. Because I've had a status go out on LinkedIn. I'm excited about my profo reading project. It was proofreading. Of course. Only because I can't see my own typing. So a careful spell check, a careful grammar review. Here's one of my pet peeves with grammar, and it's commonly done, is a shift in subject. You might say, a person, an individual, might do something like this, and then you switch into they. So, a person's mood might respond to their state of mind. A person is not they. You can use him or her, you can use he or she, even a lot. It's grammatically correct. So a person's mood might be affected by his or her relationships. Or you could make it all plural. People's moods might be affected by their relationships. Does that make sense? That's a tricky one. You see it online all the time. All the time. It drives me nuts. I'm on LinkedIn a lot. Love LinkedIn. Connect with me on LinkedIn, by the way. I love it. It'll say, Joni just updated their profile. Her. It really is. It's her. It's not that hard to fix. It really is. So that's one of my personal pet peeves with grammar, is to use they when you mean one. You can use you. You can use a person. And you can use he or she even a lot. It gets a little awkward, I admit. But there are ways to fix that. Okay. Also check your punctuation. One of the key things that is being accepted more and more, you may have heard of it, called the serial comma. Also known as the Oxford comma. It's a comma in a series, so one comma, two comma, and three. Whereas in newspapers, you'll see one comma, two, and three. And that comes from the days when you had to physically set a block, and so physically setting a comma took up more space. More and more scientific publications are using the series comma now, and it used to be they didn't. It's easy enough to put in. They can, you know, more and more publications, they'll just take it out if they don't want it. But it does make your work really a lot more readable. Maybe that's just because I'm spoiled, I'm used to it, I've been doing it for 15 years. But the series comma is an important thing to add in there. Let's see. Abbreviations. This is something that academic and scholarly publishers use a lot of, especially as you get in your field. And it is important to define your abbreviations the first time you use them. Even if you think everyone in your field, everyone who's going to read this article knows what it means, and in science I'll get things like HPLC, which is high performance liquid chromatography, and PR, polymerase chain reaction. But the journals I edited for said spell out every abbreviation the first time you use it, and then put the abbreviation in parentheses. The corollary to that is once you have made an abbreviation, then use it. I've had people spell one out and then never use it the rest of the chapter. So if they don't use the phrase in the rest of the chapter, they don't need to abbreviate it. If they do use the phrase a whole bunch more, then they need to abbreviate it. It's a little complicated, but some journals will have a separate section in the article for each article, a box just of the abbreviations. So make sure you abbreviate all your acronyms and spell them out so that people know what they are. And if it seems it's easy for them to take out, it's easier for a publisher to take out your definition of abbreviation than to query you as to what it means. Because copy editors don't always know it. If I have to say, I don't know what GPP means in this context, could you please spell it out? That's another round of edits that have to come back to you before it gets typeset. And that gets expensive. Okay. Numbers, another tricky. Do you spell them out or do you use digits? That's going to depend a lot on your instructions from the authors. If you're doing scientific stuff, anybody here do science? Okay. Commonly with science, you might use 1 through 9 and use digits for 10 and over, unless it's used with a unit, like 3 milliliters would be the digit 3 in milliliters. In humanities, generally speaking, you might spell out 1 through 99 and then use digits for 100 and above. This is minutia that can be looked up and you can request from the publisher, but this is the kind of thing you need to be aware of when you're fine-tuning. When to use digits and to spell out. And especially if you're doing science, you need to know how to handle units, like L, or it might be M capital L. Depends on the publisher's taste. And is there a space before it, or do you do 3ml, all one word? I like spaces around it. Reads more cleanly. Some journals don't like it so much. A lot of medical journals will just have as little as possible in between the numbers and the units. Okay. Lists. Bullets versus numbers. Those are the most common lists. You can also have lettered lists, which are generally sublists, and Roman numerals. They should be relatively short. You don't want a huge, huge long list of paragraphs for each item, because that might just need to be separate paragraphs. But use real bullets. Don't use asterisks. You can use Word's embedded bullet list. It doesn't typeset, but copy editors know how to fix it. I have a script that does it for me so that I don't have to. Numbers, the kind of numbered list would need to be something that has to be in a particular order. Otherwise, it should be a bullet list. And you'll need to check with the publisher whether it should the numbers be in parentheses or should be like a one in a period or something else, some other style. Lettered list, A, B, C, D, and L, usually a sublist of a numbered list, and Roman numerals would be a sublist of a lettered list. That's when you're getting really complicated. That might be more like an outline of what you have to do. You don't want to have sub lists because it gets really complicated to follow what you're doing. Okay, I'm going to speak briefly about other elements, boxes, and equations. If you do textbooks for college and high school or even elementary school, there's lots of elements. There'll be tables, there'll be this, because it keeps breaks up the page from straight text. So you might have, I just did a pharmacy textbook that had a professional focus. So here's something you might need to know when you're on the job. And then, oh, here's a test-taking tip for when you're taking your certification exam. And here's a box of just an assignment side of other interesting information that's not real critical to this but is enlightening. So know when to use those appropriately. If it's an aside to the text, something that doesn't flow, then you would use a box or whatever element they're calling it. Equations can be a little tricky. I will just say about equations that if you're using them, they should be set off on a separate line. Put spaces around all the math operators, so spaces around the plus sign, spaces around the equals, and I had something else about that. Oh, yes. All variables should be italic. Anything that's an unknown quantity. Whereas any Greek letters, beta, delta, alpha, any of those, they're already special. They don't need to be italic as well. I spent a lot of time unitalicizing alpha, beta, and all that. It's already special. Make sure they're formatted correctly as to what the publisher says. But that's pretty specialized. Anybody work with equations? A few equations. Do you do them in Word or in LaTeX?
Yeah, LaTeX. Word, I know it's fully
effective. You could do it. It's just it can't be edited in Word because it literally takes a picture of the equation and inserts them in. The other thing is that LaTeX does not translate into typesetting. Every time I get a LaTeX manuscript, which is a math-heavy one, I have to edit by hand on paper to submit it, which I don't mind. It's a nice change of pace, but I think it probably drives the typesetter nuts because they have to then rekey everything. It looks beautiful, though. If you want to do heavy math, you got to use LaTeX. Okay.
There are some things I can't do.
I've only used XML for basic style markup, not for equations. That's probably still under development, is my guess.
There are no, I can direct it comes in your business. XML, but you need to install some.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it'd be pretty tricky to do to a lot of codes to insert, would be my guess. Not a huge expert in XML myself. Just enough to get by for simple stuff to typeset. Okay, any questions about main text? I'm going to go more quickly through the rest of it. Okay, so tables and figures. And I put these as a separate thing because, especially for journal articles, tables can be the bane of a copy editor's existence. I have had so many inappropriate tables submitted, so I really wanted to spend some time on this. Let me cover figures a little bit first. Make sure the figures and tables that you're including are really important to the text, that they're truly necessary. I'll give you a good example of an inappropriate figure that I got. This was back in my really early days. I was helping actually developmentally edit this book about the web. And in this one chapter, the author had submitted 50 figures. That's a lot. Figures are expensive to reproduce. They really are. So what I realized was this author had said, here's a website that might be useful to you if you're looking for XYZ. Here's the URL of the website, see figure 2. And the figure was just a picture of the homepage. I'm like, not appropriate. It's not useful. All the reader really needs to know is the URL, because that picture is going to change. And they're not going to be able to see what they want right there on that bit. It's not illustrating a concept or data or results. So we ended up taking out all those figures, which he was like, oh, yeah, I guess you're right, which he was gracious about it, which I was good. But, you know, that's an inappropriate figure. That's a figure where you don't need one. Now, some things I have seen in terms of tables. I have seen an author create a table, take a picture of it as a PDF, and then say, figure one. I'm like, no, table one. That's table one. If it's tabular material with text, that is a table, not a figure. The other two things about tables that drive me nuts a little bit. First, tables should have more than one row because you're comparing things. I've seen tables that had just one row. I'm like, if it's just one row, you can mention it in the text. Describe, here's the data for this. Even do a bullet list if you want. But if you're not comparing it to something, it doesn't need to be in a table. Second, and this one really gets me, I see a lot of authors doing this. Tables should have more rows than they have columns. I have frequently seen 18 column, 3-row tables. It's a little ridiculous. It's going to stretch way across the page or have to be turned sideways. If it's too long, it's going to have to be set in very, very small type, which is not readable. So tables should have more rows than columns. If you make the table the way that makes sense to you and you have a whole bunch more columns than rows, then you need to reformat it and switch it around. Turn the rows into columns. It's a little tricky to do, but if they have to pay the copy editor to do it, it's going to be more expensive in the budget, and it will. And they get cranky copy editors, you know. You don't want us mad. It's easier for a copy editor to really focus on the content of your work if they're not, oh gosh, I got to reformat this table. Oh geez, this has been done wrong. So we can do a better job for you. And the job of the copy editor is to make you look good and the publisher look good, and so that people read your content and not get tripped up in your words. So tables can be a little tricky. Anybody here have to? Yeah. You probably have to generate. It's a great way to put a lot of information in a small space, so definitely use them. Some tricks to know about tables. If possible, put the units in the column heads. If one whole column is nothing but percents, put percent in the column head and delete the percent sign. If the whole column is nothing but U.S. dollars, just put dollars, U.S. dollars in the column head, delete the dollar sign off the whole column. It makes it read very cleanly, very easy to follow what's going on. If you can, align the data in a column on a decimal, if there is a decimal. So some people do it centered or left or right. If there's a decimal in it, align it on the decimal. It's easy for the typesetter to do it, so don't worry too much about that one. That one's not as critical. But one thing I have seen before is a table with a set of column headers, some data, and then a different set of column headers and some more data. That's two tables. It really is. It's okay to have the table with the column headers, part A, the Midwestern part, and then we're going to have data for that, and then part B, Southeast. And it's the same main column, just a slightly separate subsection. But I've even had tables that had five columns, and then midway down had seven columns. No, that's two tables, please. It's not table 4A and table 4B. It's table 4 and table 5. Does that make sense? Yeah, tables should be easy to follow. Tables and figures should be numbered consecutively. If you're doing a chapter in a book, you might have table 4-1, table 4-2, table 4-3 in chapter 4. If you're in a journal article, it'll just be table 1, 2, 3, and 4. And for the figures, they should appear consecutively. So, you know, table 1 should come before table 2, preferably. That's how it will be arranged by the typesetter. And every table and figure should be mentioned in the text in the order in which they appear. So I've seen articles where it says, well, see table 3. I'm like, you haven't mentioned tables 1 or 2, and they have to come before this one. So do you want to mention tables 1 and 2, or do you want to renumber this one as table 1 and then renumber the rest? Either is acceptable, but you should see table 1, see figure 1 consistently throughout the text. That indicates where they should be placed by the publisher, and that's key because you will get queries on that. Where should I put table 1? Where should I put table 2? There should be a descriptive title for each table and figure, and not just figure 1 with nothing else describing what it is. It should be short. The title of it should be short. Any explanatory material or source references or description of what labels are should appear in a note to the table or a note to the figure. Really pretty easy to do. Instructions on using symbols and letters for notes in a table. You'll see a lot of footnotes to a table. See stars, asterisks, little daggers, A's, B's, C's, 1's, 2's, and 3's. Can get a little complicated. Definitely check out instructions from the publisher or examples if you have them. Generally speaking, it's easier to use lettered footnotes in a table, especially if you've got numerical data in it, because then it's clear that's not a superscript number, that's an actual letter call out. And if you're using asterisks to indicate stuff, you can get 1, 2, and 3 asterisks. It really makes a cluttered looking table. And that's something you can get help with from your writing colleagues or professional copy editor if you want to have someone review it before you submit it. Another thing, people, I have seen figures and tables inside footnotes. I don't recommend it. It's very hard to typeset inside footnotes or endnotes. Well, just describe this. See this table. I'm like, a table in the endnotes, really? Because it's already smaller and indented. And how do you number it? So I would avoid graphical material like that in notes of any sort. And speaking of notes, footnotes or endnotes, they will vary by the publisher. A lot of people like footnotes because you can see the reference citation right there, but they are a bear to typeset, especially if you've got long notes. They may break the page in a weird place. A lot of publishers prefer endnotes. And for a journal article, that will be notes follow at the end of the text, generally before the references. For a book, the notes might come at the end of a chapter, especially if it's a multi-author edited volume, or there might be a section at the end of the book that's notes for everything. Notes are to be used when you're either citing a source, and sometimes you cite the source right in the text to keep the notes to a minimum, or when you're trying to describe a concept that's not key to the main text, but it might be important, readers might be interested in knowing. So those are what goes in the notes. Something you don't need to put in the notes, see chapter 3, if you're cross-referencing your own book. That can go right in the text. See chapter 3 does not need to be its own footnote, and it will generally be taken out, and then you have to renumber the remaining footnotes. It gets a little complicated. The use of IBID or IBID, anybody know what that is? Yes, it means basically the exact same reference as I just cited. You can use it in endnotes, but it doesn't flow well in footnotes. So in footnotes, you might have to say, Smith, 1982, page 3. Smith, 1982, page 4. Smith, 1982, page 6. Whereas in endnotes, you could have Smith, 1982, page 3, IBID 4, IBID 5.
When you're referencing notes at the end of a chapter, mm-hmm. Do you have to have like one back to the text, or can you just say, in this chapter, these are the references that we, you know, that we use?
Yeah.
You can just say, yeah. These are the references.
These are the references that we use. Yeah.
In this chapter, you don't have to reference back to a specific sentence.
No. Boy, that'd be a pain, wouldn't it? And it would change when things are typeset anyway. I highly recommend, by the way, when you're doing see chapter 3 or see later in this chapter, don't use see page XX, because that page XX won't be known until it's typeset. And that's expensive to change once it's in second page proofs. So it's like see the section on whatever in chapter whatever. Or see later in this chapter when I discuss this concept. Try to avoid the see page whatever in this book. You can cite chapters and sections. That's great. That's useful. The more specific you get, the harder it is to. It has to come in very late in the stage of publication.
I've seen notes at the bottom of pages. Mm-hmm. Is that good or bad?
That's a footnote. That's going to be based on the author's preference. The publisher's preference. Sometimes they're useful. They are a pain to typeset. They really are. And I've done one book that was one of the trickiest ones I've ever done. It had footnotes and endnotes. And the footnotes were Roman numerals, and the endnotes were numbers. And it was done this way because it was a large collection of previously published material that was already copyrighted. So a lot of this material had its own notes. But then the volume editor sometimes made annotations. Those were footnotes. Whew, that one was made me sweat a lot. It was hard to get through that one. But it was complicated. It is sometimes appropriate to have both. Generally, you want one or the other.
Is there a difference if you're using non-copyrighted material versus copyrighted material in terms of the notes or
Okay, so in terms of notes, using copy, you're talking about quoted copyrighted material. You may need help with your rewrite permissions at your publisher, because sometimes if the note that was in the original material is useful to the readers, you'll include it. Otherwise, you can just remove it. You know.
And if it's not copyrighted.
If it's your own work, then you can.
Public
domain.
Yeah.
It might be your readers might want to know where to find it, find a book, and so then you can cite, well, you know, for this version of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, you know, check this, because that went through like 18 printings and different versions. You kept adding more to it. So this is from the 1856 version, you know, which you can find reprinted here. Although I have quoted the latest version. Anything that's explanatory for your readers, essentially. Clear as mud? Okay. All right. I'm going to, another tip for note call-outs. Sometimes people put a note call-out, which is the number one or two, the actual footnote itself, in the header, like an A-head, or the chapter title. No, no, no. Don't use footnote call-outs in headers. It looks really weird. It should go in the first sentence under a header. Okay, and a note about affiliations or thank you notes. A thank you note going, my thanks to this crew for helping me write this article and reviewing it. That is not a numbered note. It's either an unnumbered note, an asterisk note, or a separate acknowledgement section. But generally that is not considered a numbered footnote or endnote, and it will have to be taken out. Also, if you're doing a book, your notes should be numbered sequentially by chapter and not the whole book. Please, God, not the whole book. I got a very large book of Korean business law in one file, and all the footnotes were sequential. There was like 560 of them. And so what I had to do, actually, was chop each chapter into a separate file. That's the only way to, that's how publishers do a book anyway. You should submit each chapter separately. So sequential by each chapter. So start over for each chapter. Any questions? Covered up my notes again. There we go. Okay. References and bibliography. If you're doing scholarly publishing, there is a lot of this. And references, they're tricky. There's a lot of minutia. Is the volume number of the journal, is it bold? Is it not bold? Is the issue number, is it in parentheses? Is it not? Do you use abbreviated page range? Blah, blah, blah. All those details. The trick with references and bibliography, I have some good news for you. Do it consistently, any which way you want. More and more publishers will say, well, we're basing our references on Chicago Manual of Style, or APA, or CSE, whatever style guide they're using. But as long as the author has done it consistently, go with what the author has. There's much less move to make it conform to a style just for the sake of conforming. Now, journal articles will be a lot more rigid about this. They'll be like, AMA style, no exceptions. Or APA, no exceptions. And if you're doing journal articles, the references will have to be done correctly. In a book, it's becoming less important. The main thing is that it's done consistently. You can do it wrong as long as you do it consistently. And that the reader is able to find that reference if they want to find it. Enough information for the reader to be able to find it. So, the key to the references, if something has been cited in the text, it must appear in the references. And generally speaking, if it appears in the references, it must have been cited in the text. If you want to include interesting things that are related but are not cited in the text, that's suggested reading. Or, you know, selected bibliography. A full bibliography should have those things that appear in the text. And a copy editor, I have to cross-check these things, and I have to query, you cite Smith 1982, but there's no Smith 1982 in the references. Did you mean Smith 84? Maybe? Or, you know, please provide it if there's nothing in there. Because it has to be in there. People have to know what you're citing. There are two potential exceptions to this. The one exception is personal communication does not appear in the bibliography. It's cited right in the text. Jones, personal communication, 2005. Because nobody's going to be able to find that if it was an email someone sent you or a phone conversation. A second possible exception are newspaper articles. Sometimes they're cited in the bibliography, sometimes they're not. They're not necessarily required. If it's really important and you cite one heavily, then you should include it in the bibliography. Okay. The order of the references. Alphabetical by first author. And you do need to check this because sometimes Word just doesn't get it right. If there's a foreign character in it, it won't recognize that as a letter. I'll give you a good example. I was doing a list of references where one of the author's name was Ostby, and it had that weird slash through the O. I forget what that's called. It didn't recognize that as a capital letter O. So all of Ostby's references went to the very end after the Z's, and I had to manually re-put them back. So sometimes it won't recognize that. Sometimes it just thinks it's wrong. I don't know why. It won't recognize a hyphen correctly. So you do have to look at your list of references to make sure they're alphabetized correctly. And then if you get like a whole bunch of Smith references, they're all B. Smith, and you got about 10 of those references, there's two different ways they can be organized. As long as they're done consistently, they can be in chronological order, either most recent to least recent or oldest to newest. Or it can be alphabetical by title. I prefer the chronological order. It just makes more sense. It's easier to find. But again, that will mostly come in directions from the publisher to the author. They'll tell you how they want the references handled. Or as long as you do it consistently, so that the copy editor say, okay, if you're doing it consistently, chronological ascending order, I'll leave it that way. Okay. Use of et al. This is commonly used in scientific publishing because usually there's a whole string of authors on a particular article, and you don't want to list 10 authors every single time. So a key to using et al., it only has one period after the all. It's two words, et al., and it's frequently not italicized. This may vary depending on the publisher, but fewer and fewer Latinisms are italicized anymore. They're just usually set regular Roman type. Your publisher may say for three or more authors, use et al. Sometimes they say for six or more authors, spell them all out the first time and then use et al. It depends. And there'll be instructions for authors on that. Again, be consistent. Sometimes the people will want you to use and others. That's more common in APA style, to use Smith and others, 1986. It reads nicely, but it takes up a little more typesetting space than et al. Okay. Citing in the text, you can either do footnotes for everything, which makes a whole lot of notes, or more and more commonly, people are offering the author date citation, which is you cite a quote and then you put Smith, 1982. Sometimes a page number if it's a specific quote. Then you don't have to have a footnote. And authors can say, readers can say, I need to go to the bibliography, Smith, 1982. Oh, that's an interesting article. I think I'll go read that. It's clean, it's neat, it's easy to follow. It reduces the use for notes. Then you can use notes for really important things, like, I've included this here, but a contradictory point of view might be found elsewhere. Does that make sense? It's consistent. Something that people don't want to see is if you have cited incorrectly. Some journal articles, you cite a reference by its number, and you list references 1, 2, 3, 4 through 50, and then you cite them. See reference 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. If the journal article calls for that, fantastic. If they call for the author date citation, please use that. One of the most difficult edits to do is to change a numbered citation style to author date. Because not only do you have to change all of that, you have to reorder all the references alphabetically. And it's a real pain, and you get a very, very changed document, and it's very hard to see what changes have been done because it all looks like it's in red ink. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions on references? Because if you're scholarly publishing, you're going to be doing a lot of references.
If you're developing a paper and you're not quite sure where it's going, because I've had this happen before where I use APA style, but also a medical journal where I use 1-2-3.
Right.
But I know it's paper, but to go back and forth, mm-hmm. How do you recommend in development of it?
Yes, I'll repeat the question because I'm recording. So the question is, when you're developing an article and you're not sure where it's going to be published yet, how should you set up the references, whether doing a numbered style or the author date style, because you don't know which journal it's going to go to yet. I was going to suggest go with what you're comfortable with. You know, if it's faster for you to do numbered references, do those, knowing that at the final cleanup, the final fine-tuning, you may have to change them back. You know, or if author date style works for you, use that at first. And some people, I get articles from authors that aren't quite done yet, and I'm helping them polish them up. And I'm like, okay, you say these authors, but I don't see them in the reference list yet. Don't forget to add them. because that can be the trick. And I've seen a lot of people when they're writing will do need reference, need citation here. Make sure you get that in there. The publisher doesn't want to see that because then they'll think your work's not done. You know, you were supposed to have it finished. Question?
Author named Scott, then it's very easy to go back and put in notes. You just go put a note in, grab that, cut it, and stick it in the notes.
It is. That's correct. Author date style, if you go ahead and put it in the text for your citation, very easy to translate to notes. Very easy to also make sure that you have it in your references list. Question?
A note, for textbooks, and I write software, so I write Adobe and Microsoft textbooks, copy editors are vital to the process, and we actually get two copy editors, one when it's still in a Word manuscript, and the other when it's in PDF or whatever the final version is when it's to print. But in textbooks, copy editors do not touch content, so they would
that is correct.
Formatting, and in fact, as an author, really encourage them to use comments whenever possible, and don't even use track changes to make a change. Just let us know what you want. Thank you very much. You're probably right. And then we can board off or accept it on our own. So I just want to clarify.
That is excellent. Yes, a copy editor doesn't do any content editing. I teach copy editing to up and come. In fact, I'm doing a workshop tomorrow on how to copy edit. People say, so do you read a book and tell the publisher what you think? I'm like, no, it sounds like a fun job. And then they say, oh, so you rewrite passages? I'm like, no, I never rewrite. I don't reorganize. I don't tell you an opinion. I've had people say, can you tell me if this is good enough to be published? I'm like, not my job. I don't do that for publishers. I'm not qualified to do that. Yes, I can help you edit your book proposal and your sample chapter, but I can't tell you whether that's going to get your book published. I can't tell you what's missing because that's not what I do. I edit grammar, spelling, not grammar so much as word usage, appropriate word usage, spelling, punctuation, clarity, light fact checking. I will cross-check references and notes and make sure everything's there that's appropriate. But I can't tell you to rearrange your work. I can't tell you unless something's really glaringly missing to me, which I will do on occasion and have done. But that's, I mean, if it's coming to me and it's got a glaring error, then that's probably something that needs to be addressed. Comment or question?
Yeah, about the bibliography style. If you use a bibliography package or even a bibliography feature in Microsoft Word 2007 now, you can change the style at any time. So you can start off at ABA or whatever, switch to Chicago.
Handy.
By pressing a button. So you don't have to decide once and for all.
Word has more and more fantastic tools in it, and there's plugins and stuff for Word. I was talking about a really good spell check, and did you know that there are specialized spell check dictionaries that you can buy? There's one, I just finished some project for a local Minneapolis publisher, and I just got to meet them yesterday for the first time. And they do pharmaceutical stuff, and they use Stedman's Medical Spell Check, which is like a $350 software package, but it catches spelling errors that spell check or word dictionary is just not gonna get. Really specialized stuff, drug names, even the trademark names, it can catch those. So those can be, if you do a lot of heavy work in those areas, you can find a specialized spell checker. If you're gonna use Word spell checker, I highly recommend Word's dictionary feature above the spell checker feature. If you're not sure about a word, do the dictionary, not the spell check. And I don't trust Word spell checker anyway. Most publishers will say, we use Webster's 11th Collegiate and various specialty ones. So Webster's 11th Collegiate doesn't necessarily match the Word spell checker. And I'm bad for just going accept all, or skip always. When I'm like, oops, no, wait, I got that. Oops, got to go back and fix that one. So I got to. You know, it's a careful spell check. You have to actually pay attention with it. But that's good to know. Word has more and more functionality that's more useful, but books are not typeset in Word. So some things don't transfer correctly, like numbered lists, embedded lists, bullet lists won't transfer correctly in Word. But I use plugins to Word that strip out the embedded and make real bullets and tabs. And that's not something an author would have to worry about. But I have done some, I think those automatically generated references are a little tricky to copy edit because it wants to select the whole thing instead of just a little portion. But it's still workable. Okay. On the bottom there, I have a section on getting help with your writing. If you've got a writing group, peer review, co-writers, colleagues, or when you're looking for content. That also might be when you pull in a developmental editor. Or if you're working with a publisher already and you're doing a book, an acquisitions editor can help you shape the content. Tell you, this needs fleshing out, this needs rearranging, maybe we need a new chapter here, have you considered this? The big picture content is what you want your co-writers, your colleagues, and your publisher to work with you on. When you get down to the level of copy editors and proofreaders, publishers don't generally have copy editors on staff. They generally use freelancers, which is how I make a living, because they freelance work out to me. You can also hire your own copy editor. I have worked extensively for one press who hires me directly, and then will send me authors because they've told the author, you need to be copy edited before we will accept your publication. And then the author pays me. That's not that often, frequently. But it will never hurt you to have a fresh set of eyes on your project. That's what copy editing and proofreading is, a fresh set of eyes. I can't edit my own work, as I told you. Once I've typed it, I can't see it. I can't. I put up my website, an editing website. Yes, I have typos on it, and I have to wait for people to tell me this. I'm like, thank you, couldn't see it. So it will never hurt you to have a review of your work by a copy editor who's going to make sure that your content is what is read, not getting tripped up in the language, if that makes sense. And the publisher, of course, will have guidelines, instructions, and support for you as you write and finish your work. So I hope I didn't overwhelm you. I know this is a lot of details and minutiae, and my idea wasn't to overwhelm you with this or make a detailed checklist, but to give you the kind of ideas of things that can improve your work on a smaller scale. You know, you're the content expert. You got the content down. I'll make sure your readers read it and really get what you have to say. That's all I had.